Those are the two tips. Mm-hmm. Ross Hardy was not fired then. That was Bob Ross.
Bob Ross.
Yes, in psychology.
And now, coming out of the school,
you
have
a lot
of faculty ran off of food that they were involved in. What kind of measures were taken, if any, to try to heal some of the wounds? What, as you came out of that initial, the very first crisis, how did you intercede to build?
All right, let's put it this way to begin with. I think nothing was done constructively to try to heal wounds. That the campus came to be divided in essentially two camps, the good guys and the bad guys, if we could put it that way, crudely, but nevertheless true. I think what happened is that you were either classified as pro-administration or anti-administration, and that therefore a kind of an isolationist technique was used. That is, those that had been extremely vocal were considered to be suspect, and those who had been very cooperative and, shall I say, submissive, were considered to be the people that should be rewarded. That prevailed for a number of years, and I do not believe that some people ever forgot. And by that I speak of faculty and administration. I'm not putting the blame on one side as opposed to the other. For my own self, my feeling was that we've engaged in something that's been destructive, but we must move on and make something of it. Because I was, even in a chamber I grew up in, because I might have said earlier, of the so in that sense, I was discouraged, but encouraged again by students and also faculty. A number of faculty who were in the same camp as I, and the fact that I admit I did fight the administration, were saying, you know, the only way we're going to build a good university or a good college, whatever we see ourselves to be in the future, is that we stay here, that we don't run from the picture, from the scene, that we continue to give our input and hopefully make of this a respectable and good school. I think in time I found, for example, with the president, I found him to be a very, very fine man this morning. That is, even though I was not recommended for promotion at the time, I thought I should have been and was worthy of it, I do not hold him basically responsible for it. I found that he gave me a lot of opportunities to grow as a faculty member, which weren't necessarily available in the first couple of years. I think as he became more involved in more details and could not be involved in as many small details, that we started experiencing greater freedom. That's my feeling when it comes to, well, when it came to curriculum making, when it came eventually even to adding to the faculty, we didn't have that much say-so in 52, 53, but nevertheless, I felt that we were growing in the direction that was meaningful.
What was the direct
pressure
for faculty governance?
Yeah. This was one of the big problems was faculty wanted, because of traditionally our acquaintance with universities and university government, in my case, not having ever experienced it really, except for 2 years at Iowa, and with my having been rather young, whereas other faculty members were older, had known it in other schools, that we started to at least say, can't we have some kind of a faculty council? If we were to have the faculty council was nothing more than sort of an employee's council, you might say. You never really dealt with issues that might be academic, or say, should we sit down and discuss what general education should be, what is the concept and philosophy of general education. Most of it seemed to be the nitty-gritty things. What do we do about parking? And incidentally, even today, our academic senate meetings, you still find a repetition of some of the same grievances that exist there, if they can be so labeled. But we didn't really get down to what I would think and what I had heard in my first 2 years of teaching. The faculty debated a philosophy as relating to general education as opposed to specialized education, which I had heard done very excellently and meaningfully back in Iowa. I had heard that, and that was my first teaching experience. And it was somewhat disappointing to me to believe that I was really not looked upon as more than somebody that worked here. I never felt that I was considered an equal. I was an employee. Not that there's anything wrong with being an employee, but I considered that as a professional person, that my training was as good and equal to anybody else's that had a PhD. And I think we had good graduate schools represented in our faculty in the early years of this institution, and probably still do, but I only remember some of the finest schools that we had. But we were never really consulted. I think this is the problem that you'll see, and why ultimately you have the great explosion on this campus, is consultation. This school has a history that it probably is hard to escape. And being an historian myself, I have to say you cannot escape your history. And therefore, as you see things created in the past and stumbling blocks that are put there, those stumbling blocks continue to remain. And as long as there is memory among faculty that are still here, and I think I can say that I have overcome, if I can use the words of Martin Luther King, that I never think in those categories. We still have faculty that believe the administration is evil and the faculty tend to be good. I do not and have never really entertained that, because I have always cooperated with the administration when I felt that there was a two-way street. Mm-hmm. When it was not a two-way street, as indeed it was not in those early years, then I felt a necessity for taking a stand. I did not feel that this continued to exist, as lack of cooperation in the latter years of Dr. Peterson's administration, though there were problems. I felt that there was not this during the years of Dr. McIntosh, and I've never felt this during the administration of Steve Horn. I felt that there is opportunity if the faculty seek the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think is that what I really believe is that we have a strange mentality on this campus that says the administration is not going to be for us, so therefore we have to be against it.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back, as you can see, mm-hmm. to the early years of the school. It's almost as if you planted seed and it's grown up into a mighty tree and you don't know how to chop down the woods. You know, you have a forest on your hands and you don't know how to clear it.
What were some of the first signs of a little bit more faculty control and faculty involvement? It sounds
I think that is true. I think that the first signs will be, as I see them, as I look back, that out of these 52 or 53 years, out of the 1952-53 years, we start to get at least some recognition of a faculty council. We also start to get committees. They're not mighty in the sense that their decisions are honored, but the very sense that they are in existence, not necessarily just on paper. They are operational as well. I think that is the first sign you start to get. I also believe that what had happened in 52, as far as Dr. Peterson was concerned, that he recognized that he had a faculty that wasn't just submissive, that he had not gotten rid of all of the recalcitrant ones, and that there were still people here that believed the same thing. I think he believed, however, that hopefully this is a faculty with moral convictions and values. And that I respected him for greatly, that I think he was a man of high ethical standards and values in a number of areas, number of categories. And believed, and this, again, one has to say, what did this person believe he was doing? I think he really believed he was doing the right thing for this institution at that time. I think he saw faculty that he did get rid of as faculty that he felt were corrupting the morals of students, and in that sense was true to his own self in that way. Because I have to always ask, I do this in history, is what did this man believe to be true, whether it was true or not? What he believed to be true, and that becomes his modus operandi, it becomes his way of operating. And I cannot say that he was doing it out of ignorance. All right, getting back to what you said, I think the first light in the tunnel might be the faculty council.
Well, how did that come to be formed?
You know, Shana, I can't really remember. I'm sorry to say that it's an area where I'd have to go back, and I'm sorry I didn't do any homework on it ahead of time. I'd have to go back, and it's something that perhaps I can explore as I hopefully discuss this with people that are retired who might be asked that ahead of time, and I might ask them to look into it, how we really got it started. And I will see that you get that information, but I cannot tell you exactly when it started or how it came about. I know that it really came about through asking and requesting and then giving, because I think it's always looking on this way. The ministration gives.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a paternalistic system that I think I referred to earlier,
mm-hmm.
that we will give you what we think you are capable of handling. And if we got a faculty council, we got a group that at least was in a position to start to discuss. But it was not a council where you had, as we have today, with the president of the university sitting on the academic
mm-hmm.
senate. As an ex officio member, we did not really have that. We met alone
mm-hmm.
as a faculty council.
Now, what sort of committees were you, and stuff that were you setting up within the department as you moved from 52 to
259? All right, I think in those years, our basic committees were, one, a curriculum committee, because we were in the process of really changing our courses. And changing our courses because we were adding new faculty to the department. And then, of course, the committee that was very, very busy was the committee we had in the department that related to screening papers. It had come to the point now where we were able to start to screen faculty between 52 and 59, not much, but a little.
Mm-hmm.
We were not really fully departmentalized. We were still a part of the Division of Social Sciences, but we called them areas, geography, history, political science. So you did not have a department chairperson. You had a departmental area representative who reported to the divisional chairman or chairperson.
And who was that at the time?
Carl Gregory became the department or the divisional chairperson. And let's see, he came, and I forget exactly what year he came, but he was the first one that was brought in who was really not a social scientist, but more than anything else, he was a man in the field of business. And he came in, well, I didn't realize that, but he came as early as 51.
Mm.
And that's when he became the division chairman and then worked with the area representatives. So he did come very early then, 1951. And it wasn't until a number of years later, and I'd have to go back and look in the record, when we actually departmentalized. And I should really know it because I was acting division chairman at the time that departmentalization took place. While the regular chairman, Dr. Canelli, who is now at Cal State Hayward as a vice president, was then our division chairperson. He was a geographer and wanted this position, and there was never any input from faculty who could be your department chairperson or division chairperson. That was a decision made by the president only. And Canelli became the division chairman or chairperson, and then I acted for him one semester when he was on sabbatical. It's then when a number of the faculty in the respective areas suggested that we ought to have departments, and I said, let's start doing it, whether we get recognition or not. And we did it on our own without. How we did that was very interesting. They said, let's start to get ourselves identified by getting not only for ourselves areas, as far as physical facilities are concerned, but also in the sense of being recognized as a distinct area from a division. What we did then is the area representatives, as we then called them, met with me, and we decided to take offices. We got approval eventually for this, of course, but to take offices, even though it was small faculty offices, and call it the department office. Then we were able eventually to get, if there were two offices contiguous to each other, we would then, well, there were, but we would take two offices contiguous to each other, cut a hole in the wall, make a door, and eventually we're going to hope that we're going to have a secretary in that next office and a department chairperson in the other office. And that's the way we did it. It was really a grassroots movement of getting departments. The chairman came back, Dr. Canelli, and he was quite surprised. I kept him informed as to what we were doing, and he said, just hope, you know, keep the revolution down or just don't let it go too far.
Was
but that's
the
essential. This was in the social science area. Yeah, this I was acting chairman, chairperson of the whole social science area, just for a semester, when Canelli was on sabbatical leave. And we took all the seven areas, anthro, geography, history, econ, sociology, psychology, and so forth, and made them into departments. We had no budget for it. There was no budget for a department chairperson. The area representative, we started to call department chairman. We used the term chairman at that time. And so we called that person department chairman. Incidentally, we did have one woman tonight, yes, we did, in anthropology, Dr. Ethel Ewing, was the chairman for anthropology. And it's during that time that we really start to get departments.
Now, what was the philosophy of the faculty in terms of building departments?
All right. I guess what we have to remember is that all of us were trained in graduate schools that were departmentalized. And you came with a unique dedication to your specific discipline. And the feeling was that we were sort of a salad bowl, and we were a mixed type thing within a division. And I think the divisional concept was purposely imposed to break down those barriers that separate disciplines, which incidentally I would believe has some merit, because sometimes we become so overly specialized that we don't see beyond our own little disciplines. But typically faculty, and at least as they were trained at that time, and probably are trained similarly today in graduate schools that grant PhDs, is that you are trained as an historian, as a sociologist, and all the rest. Their feeling was, we want eventually to have a department that hopefully will have stature, that will have some meaningful recognition within our own discipline. And as we go to conferences, we do not go to a social science conference, we go to a history conference, a sociology conference, whatever it might be. Because if you look at your national professional association, they are not social science, they are within the respective areas. So I think it was to identify with our national groups, plus the fact that we are the products of our own training, and our own training was that you were in departments. And as we saw the disciplines growing, we likewise felt that it was more manageable to have departments in time than just a strict divisional organization. The divisional organization was meaningful in the sense of coordinating everything. And I think one thing I learned through the divisional organization was working with people in all the social science disciplines, which I sadly miss now. Even though we have a School of Social and Behavioral Sciences now in 1978, nevertheless, I don't see people from the other disciplines anymore, whereas we had cross-fertilization then. Even though we organized departments, we were still physically located in the same area. We all occupied the same building here on the North Campus in what is today Faculty Office Building Number 2. All the social sciences were in that building. And you constantly had opportunity to mingle, to engage in conversation, and the committees were also basically divisional. So if you served on a committee for retention and promotion of a faculty member, it was not just for somebody in your own area or department, it was for somebody within the complete division to which recommendations came. I think what it did for me was to show me the insights that, say, an economist or a sociologist or psychologist might have that would be different from the insights that a historian may have. And I think we were really engaging in interdisciplinary kinds of things, though it was not always evident in the sense of the way we taught, but it was, in a sense, realized in the way we acted.
Were there any measures taken to formalize some of that cross-fertilization in terms of symposia or seminars on a divisional level?
Yes, we had some, but very, very few. I think that has not come to be realized until only recently, and so recently as the organization of a new school called the Social Behavioral Sciences, which hopefully will do more of that type of thing. We didn't do too much of that. I think we still, as far as a formalization was concerned, we stuck within our separate disciplines. But informally, which to me many times is more valuable than the formal structured kind of thing, we were discussing things that would relate to how a sociologist saw a given problem and then how a psychologist. And you may only have been a listener or only an observer, but you profited by it. That's the fact that we could share. I, for example, as a historian, could share with an anthropologist what insights an anthropologist has into a given situation historically and what those tools are that an anthropologist has that I wouldn't have and how I could profit by it. I don't have that experience at all anymore. I don't have it at all.
It sounds to me the way in which you described the move to create a department as if it was a way also to basically upgrade the professional standard, both nationally and on the campus.
You're right.
The individual faculty.
Yes. I think there, again, there is this sense of pride. I think the pride was that we wanted to be recognized locally, because after all, we did have affiliations and contacts with history departments and sociology departments in all the surrounding schools. And of course, what becomes your model? Your model becomes the university that you find in your immediate geographical zone. UCLA, USC, find liberal arts colleges, which is Occidental, and the Pomona colleges. Those were the things we saw, and I suppose in final analysis, those were the ones that we wanted to model.
Did the relationships to those institutions change
as became a department? Oh, yes, definitely, because as we changed and became departmentalized, there was a feeling that at UCLA, at USC, there is a department chairperson at Cal State Long Beach in history, in sociology, whom we can contact. To speak of a person as an area representative sounds strange, and anybody in the profession would look at it very, you know, peculiarly. As we got department chairpersons and spread this information around, it really enhanced, I feel, our reputation. Mm-hmm. We feel, but it was only psychological, that we were gaining in stature, but also the fact that if we participated even in regional and national meetings of our respective disciplines, that we were being accepted more readily than we had been previously.
Now, what did this mean in terms of your getting more control over, for instance, curriculum and retention and advancement,
all of the
things about control?
Yes. Really, between 52 and 59, we didn't have all that control of retention and advancement of faculty. We started to move in the direction meaningfully of having division committees that reviewed faculty for appointment, and I guess we did, if I remember correctly, also reviewed faculty for retention and tenure, only in a recommending way. Of course, and it's still that today, so it hasn't changed, and it shouldn't change. I think where we were getting greater control was in curriculum. As faculty were being added, we did not get, for example, that many opportunity to perhaps participate in the original appointment process, because I think of people that were being added to the faculty. For example, in 1956, Dr. Nichols was added to the faculty as a Latin Americanist. We did not have any say so in his appointment. Now, you see, I can look here at the catalog, see the data point, and remember that I, as a member of the department, had no say so. The reason I remember this so specifically and wanted to check the date is that I had this former student to which I originally alluded, who was in Latin America, and had given his name, but nothing could be done to even get his papers before the president for consideration. So as late as 56 and 57, it was still done by the president. Now,
was he still making recruiting tours?
Oh, yes. His recruitment and recruiting tours didn't end during his tenure as the president. He would do as much as this. He would say, for example, as he did in one case when we were divisional, he was making a tour to the east or the Middle West, I guess I can say more accurately. But as he made his tour, yes, this is also interesting, in 1956 for the appointment, so it would have been in the school year 55-56, that he was going back to the Middle West, and in so doing, he had a name of a man who had applied for the position. He found out this man had taught with me at Iowa, was now at Akron University, and he asked me what kind of a person he was, whether he was the kind of a person you could live with, which was, as I think I've said before, traditionally the statement that he asked of you, is he the kind of a person you can live with? And I said yes, and so he was still, and this was a man incidentally being appointed to the Department of Economics, Bob Strain. And so the president was still, you see, as late as 56, 57, going out and actually hiring his own people. Now, well, we started to get control of curriculum. That is, we added new faculty in the disciplines. Unfortunately, by this time, you see, by the mid, oh, I'd say 54, 55, the president was adding people in areas of history, and I speak only of that, where we said we needed them.
So you would, by that time, you were defining need in at least 2 years.
Yes, indeed. He was coming to see that and accepted it. So we added a Latin Americanist. We already had some courses because I had crossed into that area and was teaching modern Latin America, colonial Latin America, and history of Mexico. So when Dr. Nichols came, he could pick up those courses that were already there. Then as we got individuals added to the department, we would then say, okay, here's your area of interest. What kind of a course would you like to develop that would reflect that interest? Which, of course, is a typical thing, and it's one that is probably not the best way to build a department. But you take what skills you have and what competencies are demonstrated and say, well, So here's the kind of a person we have. Probably we should capitalize on it, and did. So as we added increasingly more faculty is when we then got greater control of the curriculum. And that's where we started to get the variation. I think there was a feeling at times that some of our courses were too specialized. And I think historians at that time were defending it. I would say today that historians are moving the other direction. We're saying, well, we ought to broaden our courses rather than to specialize as much as we do in order to get more students into the department and to increase our class enrollment. But we were getting, as I mentioned, I think greater control of the curriculum definitely by 1958-59.
If that's when you would then say to him, we would like this person and he would make the decision, or would he say, still say, I've looked over so and so, would you be interested?
Yes. The latter is true, that he was saying that, all right, I've looked at these people, here are the people that I have looked at, because after all, he based everything upon a personal interview. He didn't want to hire anybody unless that person had been interviewed by him or the person had been very highly recommended by somebody whose judgment he fully trusted. So therefore, the interview, we knew that it was always about February, and we jokingly would always say it's when winter is at its worst. Not necessarily, because he didn't mind the Middle West. He came from there, and if you go in February, you're not looking for the best time of the year. But it was interesting, because it was a time that you could also visit relatives, you could visit family, and nothing wrong with that, because you didn't abuse it. But what's interesting, he basically interviewed at Middle Western universities.
He himself was not from Middle West, was he?
Yes. He got his undergraduate degree, of course, at Iowa State Teachers College, where I had my first teaching position. And he had graduated from there many, many years earlier, of course. But then he did all of his graduate work at Stanford. But basically, Dr. Peterson, I think, and I respect the man, and I don't want it to go on tape, you know, that I don't, because I really came to admire him and even to this day see him, not often, but do see him, and a man with a very lively mind. But he came to believe, which is, I think, typical of his generation, that the good people in America come from the Middle West. A very provincial, but yet interesting viewing of our country. But the solid people, the settled people, the rooted people. The Eastern Seaboard, not too good. Those universities,
yes.
And you had the radical element in those Eastern liberal universities. So what would be better than Middle Western and probably land-grant institutions, you know, that type of thing? I don't know, and I cannot speak of his suspicions, but I know it was said often, you know, if you were from the Middle West and you were Scandinavian and have a degree from Middle Western University, you stand a pretty good chance that everything else is equal to getting an appointment in the school.
Now, was he giving more power to other people in the administration, or were you still, as a faculty, relating
directly to him, or was he No, you were relating to the dean. Yes, because at this time, if a student had a complaint about anything, the student would generally report to the dean would in turn report to you. We did have things at that time of students, for example, being upset by something and not coming to you, but going directly to the dean. I had that experience in these years between 52 and 59, where I was using that experience and I made an experience with a woman in class. I was dealing with the study of the Manila Galleon in the 16th century, which went from the Isthmus of Panama, as we call it today, to Manila, and there was a great deal of black market activity going on, and a great deal of money was made in doing it. And I illustrated by saying that, you know, I was in Manila right after the end of World War II, and I saw ships coming in, and I saw a great deal of black marketing activity going on by the merchant marine, which I specified, and this woman's husband was a merchant marine officer. And she attacked me after class and then reported to the administration that I was anti-merchant marine, which taught me something, and that is you have to be very, very careful. You never know whom you're going to offend. And so the dean called me up, and he was a very fine person, Dean Wesley Bratton, and J. Wesley Bratton, and he said, I want you to come up here. There's a woman that's quite upset. So I came up, and I apologized to her that I could have used, the reason I couldn't use other illustrations, I said, I know it went on, I'm sure it was the Army, the Navy, the Coast Guard, the Marines, but I said, this happened to be Merchant Marine. I was assigned to a Merchant Marine vessel. They brought in a jukebox from San Francisco because they knew the war was over. So we sailed into Manila, they sold the jukebox that they had paid about $150 for several thousand dollars, because the nightclubs were going to start to open in Manila again. But she said, you shouldn't have used only the Merchant Marine. I said, well, forgive me. I apologize. It was amazing what students would do at that time. They would report you for most anything. If you were on a particular, if you stated, this is my opinion. Now, note, this is my opinion. It is not something you have to accept. You can reject it as fast as you wish. It is my opinion. They would still report it.
To what extent do you think this was reflective of the fact that we were talking about basically the McCarthy period during that time?
Yes.
To what extent was there an atmosphere on the campus that...
Of reporting?
Of that reporting suspicion and concern about faculty being too liberal, stating certain kinds of things.
Thanks. Whether it's a reflection of that period, I don't know. But what's interesting is the ones that reported were not the typical age student, that is, early 20s. They were people in their 40s, older people. So it was they that were suspicious of anything, rather than the typical student as we think of today in the 20s. And it's not always being challenged. It could be something in the field of science. It could be something in the field of religion. I know when I taught intellectual history of the United States, I ran into the same type of thing as I dealt with the rise of Unitarianism and that. And people forget whether you're stating an opinion at times or whether you're saying what somebody or group of people believed or what a movement represented. You have to be very careful to label. I found that out. You labeled it. Please notice, is everybody awake? Are you listening? If your neighbor is sleeping, awaken him. Because this is not my opinion. I'm stating a fact at this moment, whatever a fact might be. But I explain what I'm trying to say. Or if it's an interpretation, this is so-and-so's interpretation. This is somebody else's. If you want to ask me what mine is, feel free to do it. But at this moment, I'm giving somebody else's.
You feel from your conversations with colleagues and other institutions at that time that the experience here around those sorts of reactions of students and reporting was more extreme than it was out there?
I couldn't say because the experiences I had were basically limited. I've given you a couple and it sounds as if I'm generalizing, which I'm not. But I learned out of it, and probably it was good for me as an instructor, but I learned that you must be very, very careful in teaching that you don't throw out something that can be subject to a number of interpretations, or not knowing that you're quoting at the time, or you're stating your conviction or your opinion. Probably it was a learning experience for me.
The reason we're asking, when we're talking with Dalton, that when we're talking about that time period, when we're talking about the students that are in their 30s, there are the students, for instance, that in language they expect they say, they're out of the field,
how one can say that. I have no evidence to prove it, because these are very isolated, you know. In fact, I don't want to give anybody the impression that we had a lot of students of this type. What I'm trying to illustrate is that in talking about a chain of command and my relationship to the administration, the reporting was generally done to the dean, and my experience was that to the dean that person went, and it was not the president at this time that called you in. It was a dean who called you, and I appreciated the fact that we had a dean that was willing to take the time with a student and with a faculty member to sit down and discuss these things. I'm not sure that everything was reconciled, and the woman was afraid in this instance, particularly with the Merchant Marine, that there'd be retaliatory measures taken. And I said, you never have to be afraid of me. Your grades, you've done well in this class. I see no reason why you shouldn't continue to do well. I want you to speak up in class, and in fact, I said, what I wish you had done that day was before the whole group had said, well, now you've said this about the Merchant Marine, couldn't the same have been said about the Army, the Navy, other groups as well? And I said, we would have cleared the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And I might say incidentally, she continued in the class, and she did do it after that. Anything came up, she participated in the discussion. And I think it was clearing of the air, mm-hmm. which probably was needed. But what made me wonder is that I had one other experience, and that's interesting. I had a student, a young, and this again is interesting, a young student by the name, who was Irish, and it's interesting because the day is St. Patrick's Day. And this student always would tell me when I came in, he said, I got another joke on the Irish I want to tell you. And he was the Irishman, I was the Swede. A man in class, again a man in his late 40s, was Irish, and reported to the president or to the dean, I forget which, that I was anti-Irish because I listened to these jokes. Which he never told me that, but it was interesting. It was the Irish boy telling me just before class, got another quote for you, got another story for you on the Irish. But he thought that I was feeding the student to do it.
Hmm.
But again, it tells me something, and that is that the complaints came from the older students, never from the younger students.
Now, when did you feel that sort of thing began? Did you feel it in the earlier period?
I felt it really between, well, I hate to put dates,
yeah.
kind of hard. I think I felt it in the early years. Let me put it this way, in the early years of this institution. I have not experienced anything like this in the past 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. And it can be that I've matured, you know, in the sense that I am sensitive to being very careful, and that's what experience does for a person, I think, of saying, now, this could be interpreted in a wrong light, so don't let this go on. Plus the fact that I've learned different teaching techniques by which I can divert people's attention at the moment, saying, okay, will you listen to what we're doing now? Whereas probably in the first 4 or 5 years, I wasn't as astute to that type of thing. And yet, even today, any one of us that teaches is open to this type of thing. You can do it so easily
mm-hmm.
with no connotation in it that has race or sex or anything, but you might touch on somebody's interest group, whatever that interest might be.
I was just wondering the extent to which it reflects the attitudes about knowledge and education in the period and general political attitudes, and also the extent to which it might have indicated an open line of communication that students felt more able in a smaller school to go to a dean.
Right.
They felt distressed about something.
All right. I think one is, from the bureaucratic point of view, we were small. It was very easy to find somebody with a door open, and you could go and explain what your problem was. That definitely is true. And I think you'll find in a smaller situation, because I happen to be a trustee in a small college of about 850 students, and I can see the difference between that kind of a community and this kind of an academic community, where everybody knows what everybody's doing. All right, everybody knew what everybody was doing, essentially, in our campus in those early years. Even when we got to be larger and had 2,000 to 3,000 to 4,000 people, you got to know an awful lot. All right, the administration consisted of people that were accessible to students.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe also you cannot forget the mental environment of the day. So as you look at the whole decade of the 1950s, where there was a great deal of suspicion about what anybody was doing and might be doing, I think that kind of feeds into
mm-hmm.
this category as well. Yeah, you're right. Both.
I'm wondering, we talked a little bit about the temperabilities and the change in the apartments where they became down to the cantina. What was physically center in terms of the place that people would gather for coffee? What is that same feeling of there being some sort of central area in which you congregated during
right.
the days of the temporary buildings?
To know the physical layout of the temporary buildings on lower campus, you had a library which was centralized, which is, in my thinking, the way the library should have been built on this campus, but it wasn't. But I think in the temporary buildings we had a concept. The library is the center, which incidentally was a building that was moved from by the apartments to this campus. Secondly, we still had a large canteen area with a very large, at least it seemed to us at that time, space with picnic tables where the students and faculty could have coffee and even have lunch with each other. We still did not have really hot meals or anything of that nature, but you could get a sandwich, you could get a variety of things, or if you brought your lunch, there you would meet. It became and was the meeting area. It was very unique. It was sort of like, well, it was blacktop, so it wasn't the village green, but let's meet on the blacktop over by the tables. And I did that often with students. In fact, if compared to today, I can't remember in this school year that I've gone down with any student to say, let's go down and have a Coke together, or let's have lunch together. No. And of course, part of it's reflected in the fact that I teach only one class now compared to then I taught four classes and being involved in administration. But I found it was very meaningful because students wanted to meet with you and you had a place where it wasn't a problem. It was easy to get to logistically. And it was planned in such a way that we wanted to encourage. This was basically, and there again, you've got to give the administration credit, or I have to give the administration credit, it wanted to encourage fraternization between faculty and students. That this is not a game.